right here, so. Oh, we topped it. Whoa. Cold topped it.
Okay. Ready to go. Yeah.
Big iron.
Oh, shank this. Oh, look at that line, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, boy, is he out of sync.
Welcome to the Bogey Boys podcast.
You're joined here by Kevin and Mark, as always. We've got a special guest, Mr. Chris Hansen. How are we, Chris?
Guys, I'm great, thank you. Nice to see you both, and nice to be on the show.
No, great to have you on, mate. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time. I know it's busy.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all, guys. Always nice to talk golf, especially at the moment.
Yeah,
well, that's it. I said, Chris is one of our... me and Mark both went to Myersco as well. Obviously, we didn't do as well as you out of it. Like, but we were there and we got the experience. That's all that counts.
You got the T-shirt, yeah?
You got the T-shirt, yeah, and the prospects tour clip.
Yeah, so how's things at the moment, Chris? Yeah, with the lockdown, obviously we're back open as of today, aren't we? How's things?
Yeah, it's been good, mate. Yeah, so I've been full-time sort of coaching from September. I had a busy September, October. It's been real good, really rewarding, really enjoyed it. You know, different levels of golfers from beginners through to guys wanting to come and just do performance and not just technique as well. So it's been very varied, but really good. Got some guys back into golf who haven't played for years and who are really enjoying playing again, which is fantastic. And lockdown obviously came at an interesting time, but it was a chance to get lots of planning done and get ready for a busy winter. So yeah, all's good, family's safe and well, and just itching to play golf again.
Brilliant. Yeah, likewise.
You get much practice in yourself?
No, not really. I'm in the studio now at Cross and Deith. I was up here doing a few days of work in lockdown, just getting ready for sort of tomorrow and today, and hit a few balls over the last month really. And but I guess over the last maybe 3 months I've probably done more practice than I have done in the last 10 months. You know, since last September, last October, November at Q School, I really put the clubs away and had some time off. I was getting back into it a little bit in March, played Sunningdale foursomes and was itching a little bit to play again. And then lockdown came in. And to be fair for me, it came at quite a good time, really. I think I needed that sort of that break, and it obviously was forced upon me as opposed to taking the break. So I think it worked well for me. Personally, and I think now I'm itching to be around golf and playing golf and practicing and teaching, and I think I'm really looking forward to the next 12 months.
Yeah, it's definitely a good time to be around the sport, isn't it? It's flying at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's booming, isn't it? Yeah, I've not spoken to any professional at a golf club who hasn't had 50 new members.
Yeah,
I know it's a challenge there for them to keep their members now, but I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure a lot will do. I don't know, but when football starts up again with fans, it'll take a hit, won't it, on a Saturday and things. But
yeah,
I think people, once they get that golf bug, it does last for a while, doesn't it?
100%, yeah.
I'm actually hoping the opposite. I'm hoping a few people stop playing golf so I can get into either SNA or Westlands, because they're both there in the fall.
And to be able to get a tea time somewhere.
Yeah, it's a nightmare at the minute.
Exactly.
Fastest finger first on the BRS at the moment, it is.
Nuts, isn't it?
Nuts, yeah. But yeah, like I was saying there, the idea of these episodes is, obviously, you're a professional, you've been at the high level, the elite level. It's just the professional route to give young amateurs coming through and a bit of insight into what it takes to get to that level, and just to talk through your journey as an amateur right through to the professional and how things have changed and stuff. So. Yeah. Obviously, if we go back to, obviously not the very start when it first began, but obviously when you got to a position in your game where you thought, you know what, I'm good at this game. I'm gonna give it a go, give it a crack. Was that a couple of years before Myersco? Was it an early age? How did it work for you?
No, it was probably, I played football and golf, Sunday league football and junior medals on a Sunday. And as soon as they started clashing at sort of 12 years old, I had the easy option to play golf because my parents played. But it probably wasn't until really going to Myersco when I got there, then I thought, you know what, I'm going to knuckle down. I want to be a golfer. I don't know what else I'm going to do. And probably took it more seriously there than probably maybe you two did, but
definitely more than we did. We were in the stumbling every week.
yeah. You were stumbling out, weren't you?
That's it, definitely.
But yeah, no, I took it seriously. No, I enjoyed my time at Myersco massively. And a lot of my good mates are from Myersco. And, but I did structure it around practice, and you know, I worked pretty hard there, so it did I always say to people, if it wasn't for my ISCO, I wouldn't have gone tour. And I do believe that, because if I was just going to a college in Huddersfield and I wasn't driving, and I wouldn't have been up there every day of the week practicing and playing golf. I'd have got up a couple of nights and it'd have been dark or whatever, or weekends. But my ISCO, you're there on the door, you're there every day, aren't you? And I think it was exactly what I needed. And yeah, I don't regret any of it. And I think the path my ISCO put me on was a good one.
When you're saying that you structured your practice and stuff, like, how did you actually, were you living on campus? Was it in my ISCO?
Yeah, I lived on campus. Yeah, I wouldn't say it would be as structured as it would be over the last few years, because I had the knowledge to what I needed to do. But in terms of like getting up at 7 o'clock, hitting balls before lectures, in between lectures, after lectures, and quite disciplined to doing what I wanted to do and not sort of dragged along by your mates and doing stuff. And I mean, you get the piss taken out of you a bit. I want to go and practice in the morning, so I'm not going to go out tonight. But that was what I wanted to do. So that's kind of the way I looked at it. It was an opportunity to get better. And I think, I don't know who else, not many people from my school have probably gone on to play much on tour. Tom Murray, some other lads. But I think it certainly helped me being quite disciplined at a young age.
For you and for your perspective, what was your handicap, and how did that change over the time? Obviously, you go to my ISCO at 16, and
yeah, so I got to my ISCO, I was off 3 handicap at 16. So yeah, I mean, it's nowhere near what top 16-year-olds are off now, are they? They're off scratch +2, +3, +4, whatever. But at the time, I think I was the lowest handicapper at my ISCO. So don't get me wrong, at 3 handicap at that age wasn't a world beater, but at my ISCO, I was the best player there. So that probably helped push me along a little bit, kind of in my back of my mind, I guess. Like, I think now there's lads off plus handicaps, isn't there? Loads of them.
Yeah.
I got down to scratch when I was 18, but then I was still off scratch when I was 20. Like, I played for Yorkshire men's team. I was like the 12th man. Never really. I was kind of like the last pick, tagged along at 12th man, and never really did anything really great in amateur golf. I think I got into the British boys at Hoylake as a reserve one year and finished semi-finals, which was like, I was like the highest player in the field, and like got through to semis, which was like, I don't know, just a bit of luck, I guess, really. Just had a good week. But yeah, I was off scratch at 20. So I did 4 years at my high school, 2 years ND, 2 years HND, then decided that I was going to turn pro. A guy was going to give me $5,000 in the local area. So I'd kind of made my mind up, I was going to have a crack at it. And then as soon as I'd kind of made my mind up, I'd like in the next 3 months after finishing my ISCO, I got down to +3, but only within Yorkshire. Nothing. I played the England, what's it called? The match player one twice, lost in the first round. That was it. So I think I got 3 or 4 course records locally, won a few Yorkshire divisional things.
Yeah.
And got down to +3, and that was it, really. There's no career to shout about. And that's what I used to quite like, coming to my ISCO and saying to people, like, you don't have to be in these squads to make a living at golf. You just have to have a bit of a plan. You have to have some structure. You have to have good people around you. You need to get your finances in a decent place, whether that's sponsorship or whether you're fortunate enough to be in a family with money, or have a job where you can work around golf. And I think that's pretty important from a young age. I'd always say to people, like, save, like, okay, enjoy yourself and spend some money. But if you wanted to be a pro golfer, you might not get any help. And if you can put 100 quid away every now and again, when you turn pro and you've got a little bit of cash to play with, then you're ahead of the game, because there's a lot of good players who can't play because they ain't got the money.
Yeah.
So, discipline teams as well. You got to discipline to save, and then discipline to practice as well, haven't you?
It is discipline, and it's an individual sport, but it is a team sport for me as well. You've got to have good people around you, but at the end of the day, it is an individual element to it, where you've got to dictate what you do. You are the boss. You've got to be disciplined. Yeah. And I think it is true, if you're not doing it, someone else is in golf. And look, for young lads watching, or young lasses watching this now, like, it's only getting harder, because I say to everyone, there's probably 100 more pros every year and there's nowhere else for them to play. So the depth of these tours is getting stronger and stronger, because there's always 100 turning pro and there's always 10, 15 really good players. Like, so they're going to slowly get through the system, and the standard's just getting better and better. I know, look at Dubai today. I've not seen the scores again, but the course is obviously played very easy, but 11 under, 9 under, 9 under, 8, 7, 7, 7.
Andy Sullivan had a 61.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? And I think that's the thing. It's not getting easier. The pool's getting bigger, and the opportunities are getting smaller. So
yes,
it's tough, isn't it? It's like professional football, isn't it? Like millions of kids in the academies, but not many actually do it, is it? And that's the reality, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what we're finding when we're doing these professional routes. Is we spoke to a couple of guys who were just getting started in the game, and we've spoke to one of the guys, Sean Townsend. I'm not sure if you know Sean. Yeah. He beat John Rahm in the British Amateur, and obviously yeah. John Rahm's gone on to do what he's done, and Sean's obviously just starting that journey now. He's playing on the Euro Pro Tour next season. Yeah. But then obviously you've got people who haven't had that caliber of amateur career. We spoke to a couple of guys who went to my school. Tom Eakson, who we haven't had that caliber of starts, but obviously there's no reason why they can't go on to do the things what you've done. It's great to see the journeys, and it's just like you say, it's about that dedication, isn't it?
Belief's a big thing, but I think it's hard. This is a hard thing because it was never in my nature, but you've got to be selfish, you know, like it's a selfish sport. There's a lot, not just discipline, but there's a lot of sacrifices, and like you do miss a lot, and you should miss a lot because you've got to like, you look at the best players in the world, like they only care about themselves. Like they're on the range, they're doing what they do, and they might come across a bit arrogant, but I don't think a lot of them are. I think that's just their bubble when they're at events, and that's just the way they play golf. But then off the course, I'll give you an example of someone. One of the nicest guys ever on tour, Adrian Ategi. But everyone would think he's pretty arrogant or just a bit rude because he doesn't speak to anyone.
Yeah.
Like you'll play 5 hours with him. He won't talk to his caddy. He won't talk to me. But off the course, I've roomed with him. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's just his way of doing golf. He's selfish. He's one dimensional. He's focused on what he does and doesn't give a shit about anyone else. And you have to be like that. You have to be able to maybe switch in and out of it, and still be a nice person and still help like sponsorship things and time for people and fans and things. But I think when it comes down to it, a lot of players get a lot of stick of being quite rude or like ignoring people. But for them to perform, do their job, that they've got to do what they've got to do. And that's what makes them tick, isn't it?
Tommy Fleetwood, he can come across quite like, he's obviously a nice guy now and he speaks to a lot of people like now, but when he was sort of coming up, he's got no real like social skills and stuff. So he's obviously been alone, practicing, come up through all the golf tours, lonely. And then obviously now his personality's coming out a bit on the European tour, if you know him quite well. But so obviously you've got that sort of loner aspect of it as well, haven't you?
Yeah, massively. Yeah. I struggled my last year on main tour and a bit challenged to like you're a pro, you used to kind of muck in with loads of lads, get a house and be 5 years in a house, challenge tour similar, get on the main tour. You kind of everyone's I didn't really have like real good friends on tour. So I had a lot of people. I got on with everyone, but like my family traveled to maybe 10 events each year. And then the rest of the time I did a lot of it on my own. So you go out for dinner with people, but then you are on your own quite a lot. And don't get me wrong, traveling and playing, when you're playing well, traveling's the easiest thing in the world. You know, like you're itching to get to the next event. You jump on the plane, you're buzzing, get me to the course, play, practice, you're excited. If you're playing crap and you're struggling, then you don't want to get on a plane. You don't want to go to another hotel. It goes from being like the easiest job in the world to like the hardest, loneliest job in the world.
Yeah definitely. We'll talk us through that journey then, Chris. So obviously you've turned professional after you've finished Myer School. How was it for you beginning off with the tours? Did you try Euro Pro first and then eventually Challenge before making it the European? And how long did it take you to get to the top tier?
Yeah, long time. Yeah. So I started Euro Pro 2006. Pretty naive to it, really. I missed the cut at final stage by one on Europro. So I was third reserve for the first event, got in, made the cut by one, and then shot 6 under back nine to finish third in my first event. So all of a sudden it kind of re-ranked me, got me in all the events and kind of kept me going again. Missed the next two cuts by miles, and then I got lost in the 8-hole playoff, and then I won 2 weeks later. So I kind of, out of nowhere, finished sixth that year on the rankings, missed out by 50 euros, I think, on getting a Challenge Tour card. So I had a really good first year, won like 20 grand, just straight out of the blocks, and had some sponsorship and stuff. And it was a good year. and I'd say probably treaded water for 2 years, really. Didn't really progress. Had a couple of chances to win, didn't do it. Got a bit fed up, started my PGA training, did a few years of playing pro-ams. But then just said to my wife, like, I need to go and play again. Like, there's unfinished business. I'm going to give it one more year full-time. And committed, changed coach, committed to EuroPro again, and won the Order of Merit in 2011, won three times that year. So kind of not out of nowhere. I had a real good process. My coach, we changed some stuff. I was lucky that I changed coach and he was the right guy at the time. So yeah, progressed into Challenge Tour. So then started Challenge Tour in 2012. Second event, finished fourth in Colombia. Good start, but then fizzled out. Just missed keeping my card fully. So I had like an average category the next year, did the same again, finished like two spots outside of keeping my card. So another average category. Then I made the cut of Q school. So I had a decent run at it the next year. Then the fourth year, I was about to pack it in again and I'd had enough. I was done. I'd run out of cash. And a guy at the golf club paid for Q school. So I ended up going to China, got to the grand final, got to final stage Q school, then got my card at Q school for the main tour in 2015, end of that year.
It's interesting you say that about the cash. So what type, you say you ran out of money, and obviously that's what was this, you being backed by someone, and then that obviously that back can come to an end at a certain period of time. Was that how it worked for you?
A bit of everything, really. Like I've been fortunate enough to never get myself into debt playing golf, whereas a lot of people have. You know, I've always managed to get sponsorship together, worked hard for sponsorship, always tried to give back what I could, whether it was time or money back, or, you know, like sponsorship load, whatever it could be. I tried really hard on that side of things. So I always managed to get my expenses paid pretty much. But then obviously I had living costs as well. I had a house and two kids at the time. I've got three kids now, like two kids at the time, and life's expensive. So obviously it got to the point where it was kind of, what do you do? I'll tell you a quick story I've told a lot of people. Back in 2014 was another point when I was going to pack it in, and I just missed the cut in Scotland and Aviemore, a Challenge Tour event. Me and my caddy were driving home and spoke to my wife, and I was upset. She was upset. And she's like, what are we going to do? Like, our bank was at zero, like struggling. And I just said to her, listen, the next month of golf, I've already paid for. Like, the hotels, the flights had already been paid for. I said, I'll play this month and see what happens. And if I don't do anything, I'll pack it in. So that was this Friday. Following Tuesday, qualified for the Open at Hillside. So like $3,000 for winning the Open qualifying. You get $3,000 for finishing last at the Open. I got $3,000 for something else. My sponsor gave me $3,000 to pay for the digs. And then I flew to Germany the next day and finished fourth on the Challenge Tour, won $10,000. And all of a sudden I kind of like thrown $20,000 in the bank out of nowhere. And just, that was it. Back playing golf again. And like got like a bit of a second wind, and then jumping forward, to the end of 15 when I got my card at Q school. Again, I was about to pack it in, and I only did 2 years of my PGA training. So I called the PGA, said, listen, can I finish my final year? Can I like carry on? And they said, oh, you've missed out by 6 months or something of being able to carry it on. You'll have to start again. I said, I'm not doing that again. Like, I'm not starting from the beginning. So I ended up going to Q school and got my card. So if they'd have said to me, yep, you can carry on, I wouldn't have gone to Q school that year. So
wow.
It says here as well, Chris, that you were the last person to get your card on that sort of, on the 2015 one as well.
Yeah, I made a right bollocks of it, yeah, last round.
It was just funny, innit, that you're the last person, but then obviously it shows you that you could have made a different decision and went down the PGA route, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I was leading Q school for like 4 rounds, I think, cruising it. And then shot 2 over like 5th round. I was like 10th or something. I think I shot 6 over last round and got the last spot, last card or something. So
you're in though, aren't you?
I was in, yeah. But the problem is, like, there's a big difference in finishing first and last.
Yeah.
Luckily, I had a couple of decent results early on and it re-ranked me. So there was a re-ranking like July, and it moved me from like 30th to like 11th or something. So that meant I got like another five extra events or something that year. So yeah, so then the tour started, really. So yeah, 16 was my first year. So obviously that was the year I did that and re-ranked. I was leading in Morocco in May, I think. Overnight leader on the Saturday night. Shot 1 over last round or something. Finished fifth. I think I finished fourth. So yeah, 50 grand or something, or 60 grand check or something out of nowhere. It's like buzzing.
58 grand.
Wife's like, how much have you run? I'm like, 60 G's or something. She's like, whoa. And then you see that come in the bank.
Hey, would you know, Chris, just to stop you on that one, on the Morocco one, obviously, yeah. I don't know if you know the prize fund beforehand, 250 grand you've got there if you win that one, you're overnight leader. Like, are you thinking about that on the Saturday night, like before you go to bed, or what's the thought process like?
Do you know what? I can honestly say I've never thought about money on the golf course. Like I've always been quite very process driven, very like in the moment, like every shot meant a lot to me. Like, I think probably too much. Like, I always wanted to finish one shot better, one position higher. I don't think people could play golf if you're so over a putt thinking, gee, if I miss this, I'm losing 50,000 or something. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like, as soon as you get off the golf course, like there's a sheet on the Sunday, like of the breakdown. And you like whiz down, you finished 30. If you whiz down a lot, 30 grand, one shot better, I'd have won 40 or 50. And you're like, that's for me, like, I'm the first person to pull that sheet up and see what I've won. Whereas, like, some guys don't care, you know, they're not bothered. Like, it doesn't matter to them. But yeah, I'd be the first one, pull the sheet over, put it in my back pocket, working out to the penny what you've won, sort of thing. On the golf course, not at all. And I think, you couldn't play golf thinking that. So,
I was more thinking the overnight on the Saturday when you know you're leading going into the final round, aren't you? Not in Morocco. Like, is it clicking in your mind? Like, Jesus Christ, if I have a good round, quarter of a mil there, do you know what I mean?
No, not really. I think the hardest thing is the amount of messages you get and shit. Like, looking back, you turn your phone off, you put it aside, you ring your family, right, my phone's going off and I'll speak to you tomorrow, sort of thing. Like, obviously social media is crazy these days, isn't it? And like your messages and...
Yeah,
and you've got people texting you saying, "Oh, can't wait to see you lift the trophy," or "You've won," sort of thing. It's like, do you know what I mean? Like, you work so hard to stay present, and you've got people telling you like outcomes. So that's that's a hard thing, because you want to speak to your family, you want to talk to your mates, but probably not the time. Like, they talk to you about all the things you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
So you know they don't mean any harm, do they? But it's not. No,
they just want to see you do well, don't they?
Because
they want you to win, and obviously, but they don't realize sometimes those type of messages, when you've read them, how that could impact the performance.
Yeah, exactly. Next day, exactly. Yeah.
Just slightly going back there to 2014, you mentioned that you qualified for the Open. What was that experience like? Because that was that your first and only Open, was it?
Yeah, I'd played a couple of tour events, just from a poor challenge tour category. But it was my first only Open. Yeah, and I think it was an experience. It wasn't like, I wasn't going there to do well. You know, my game was not in a great place. I'd been struggling on challenge tour. I got in the Open and it was sort of like, wow, you know what I mean? Like, I've played a few tour events and had that experience, but you know, when you're signing at the Open at the time, it was like, here, you've got 2 credit cards for the week. There's 500 quid on each one. Go and buy what you want in the cafe, like mum's taking bottles of wine with her and stuff back to the house. And stuff. You know what I mean? Like, And it was like, wow, like you go on, like the trucks and the Open experience is very different. And I was a bit like, it was just an experience. I played with some good players and stuff and enjoyed it, but I didn't play. I played crap, really. I think.
Who did you play with, Chris?
In the actual event, I played with 2 qualifiers. You do get a crap draw, don't you? You go out last or first or something. So
yeah,
4 o'clock on Friday, you're going down the fifth and everyone's walking home. And it's like, it's a bit shit, really. I played with Oscar Florin and the Japanese guy. He missed the cut by one. But I played with Cabrera in practice round. Played with, a few major, Ben Curtis, Jakobsen, a couple of Americans. I didn't put my name down with anyone big. I think, Cabrera's pretty big, but none of the big guns now. But yeah, no, it was good. It was an experience. I'd walked out onto the first team. My family surprised me. They all had yellow Team Hansen shirts on in the stands and stuff. And
brilliant.
Managed to get my tee shot away on the first, and that was all right. So yeah.
At the most,
send them away. You don't need that. See that Team Hansen. Help me get away from me.
Jeez, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
Is that the most nervous you've ever been then on a tee, is it? I imagine that.
To be honest, I ripped it both days. And I just remember hitting it, walking across to my caddy. I think he was crying. He was in bits, like, he's like, how did you do that? And I was just like, I fucking don't know. You know, people, it's funny because people think you should hit driver because it's the biggest club in the bag and you won't miss it. I didn't dare hit driver because I thought if I spray it, it's going miles offline.
Yeah.
So I had like this like chunky Adams hybrid iron thing and hit two decent shots, to be fair. But yeah, I just thought if I hit driver, I'm hitting the biggest slice ever off that tee and it's going to look worse.
Yeah, I made that mistake. I don't know if you remember, just going back, we went to a MySCO alumni and I winged three tee shots off the first tee, all out of bounds and after NR on the first. And it was actually, you in the do later, you turned up and you actually presented me with a prize for being the first person to ever NR on the first tee. Unbelievable, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, learned me lesson there. So if I ever make it to the Open, which I won't, I'll be sure to not take it out off the tee.
You're really iron, yeah.
Out of all Chris's stories that he's told you, that clip is going to be our promotional video of you getting that in our. I'm going to try and find a picture of it and everything.
Brilliant.
So yeah, so that was my first year on tour. I was 16. So I ended up keeping my card. I finished top 10 in Holland, which got me into Italy the week after. And then I was leading in Italy. I think I played a Willett last round and I finished like 30th or something. But that got me enough cash up. I didn't know at the time, but that got me enough cash up to keep my card. But I didn't know. Played Dunhill, missed cut, and then went to Portugal last event. And I was like 108 or something on the rankings. And that year, 110 kept the card. And I made the cut. And then I made the cut quite easy, actually. And then bad third round. And I shot 5 under last round, won about $6,000 or something. And we were sat in the caddy shack after watching the projected rankings go up and down all day. I went from like 108 to 106 to 112, 115. But I ended up keeping my card in 108. I think 111 kept the card. And to be fair, that $6,000 didn't make a difference. But so that was a nice feeling though, because I knew then that it re-ranked me to like proper full card then. And luckily for me, like my years on tour, like the Rolex series started. So I was getting into Wentworth, Italian Open, Scottish, Irish, all the big 7 million events the following year and knowing that I would do that. So big game changer, really.
So how does that impact your scheduling? So obviously you've got the full card. I imagine you can plan everything then where you stay and book your hotels in advance. You're not just waiting for the phone call. Did that improve your game throughout the years to come then, did it?
Yeah, I guess you can plan more, can't you? You can, like my first year I played 21 events and that was every event I could play. I don't think I missed one. The next year I played 29 events and planned it. Like I did miss quite a few events because I could have played probably 35, 38 events. So, but then like you say, all of a sudden you play the Rolex events, you don't want to maybe play 3 weeks before, so you are planning gaps. And I had a good year. In Morocco again, I finished fifth, which was $80,000 because it was bigger prize fund. And then I don't think I came close to winning that year, but I finished 89 on the rankings and like doubled my prize money, I think like 420 or something that year. So, again, category was great for the following year. And I was buzzing, absolutely flying. So winter, you don't really have a winter when you're on tour. It's like the tour just plays all year, doesn't it?
It follows the sun like it's in South Africa, like Dubai. Well, it's winter here.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but you get, like Challenge Tour, you get like 4 months off. EuroPro, you get 6 months off. It's crazy, really. So 2018 started, high hopes. But I messed up big time. I was chasing distance like nearly everyone was, changing equipment. Like I'd gone from being one of the best drivers of the ball, like not the longest, but above average, but straight, decent iron player, decent driver, but didn't never really putted well enough to like chasing distance, changed to Callaway. Fucking hell, I tried 13 different driver heads that year, rogue heads. That's how many models they had out to the pros.
Yeah.
Tried every one nearly. And like all of a sudden I went from not hitting it left ever. My miss was just like a little block right. Snap hooking it again. But like naive to it, like TrackMan hitting great shots, distance further, great. Hit one left, don't matter, practice round. Keep going. Bad one, don't matter about it, keep going. On the golf course, hit one bad, you make 7.
Oh, yeah.
So like, all of a sudden, I'd gone from like, my round of golfs were normally sort of 3 birdies, 1 bogey. That was like a typical round of golf. Didn't make many birdies, didn't make many mistakes. All of a sudden, I was still making 3 birdies, that was it, but making a 7 or a double or losing a ball. all of a sudden I was like, every first round I was shooting one over, one and two over instead of one, two under. So then the Friday was always trying to make the cut as opposed to pushing up the leaderboard. And it took me, I don't know, till June to change back to a TaylorMade driver at the time, which wasn't the best driver for me, but it didn't go left. Might have been coincidence, but then I went and made three cuts in a row, and it's a little bit too late, really, but started playing quite nice again. So that was my bad, really. Changing equipment was a big mistake for me. I had a few off-course things as well, which the crazy thing was, I actually was using a Callaway driver beginning of the year, and I finished fifth in Dubai Desert Classic. And like, of all the events for me to do well in, that for me wasn't the event I'd do well in, like a birdie fest. And yeah, shot seven under last round to finish tied fifth with like seven people. So I ended up, it like watered down the cash to like, I got 50, I think. It should have been like 100. No. But that was a great start to the year. You know, I'd come out of the blocks and made the cut in Malaysia or something, made the cut in the Middle East every time. I think did well in, obviously, the Classic. And then I missed eight cuts in a row then, from then or something like that.
So with saying that then, obviously, of the purpose, like you said at the beginning, the purpose of these episodes is to give insight to young lads coming up, so hopefully they don't make the same mistakes. What advice would you give them, given that experience that you've had? What's the one thing that sticks in your mind from that?
Well, straight away with equipment, if you've got something what works, like, you need solid evidence that what you're changing to is better. Like, not just on a track, man, like, on the golf course. Like, and I don't think enough people actually have enough time, or maybe have the time, but not the right environment or the good enough equipment to actually test if it's the right thing for them. You know what I mean? Like, so if you've got a driver which is pretty, if you know what it does, if it has a one-sided miss, it's a winner. Like, if it just goes right, it's a winner. If it goes both ways, you're fucked. You know, you've got to stand on a tee. You've got to stand on a tee under pressure and know it won't go left.
Yeah.
Because if you're under pressure and there's an out of bounds left, you know it's not going there. Like, one in 100 might. And that's, for me, straight away, like, you need a one-sided miss. And if your equipment works, like, don't change it. Or if you're going to change it, test it over a period of time. Don't just, like, hit 10 shots and go, that feels nice, I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
For me, 100%. Like, too many people. And I think on tour, it's so hard to do that because these reps are pushing you to use their clubs. And like, they'll be on you like a rash. This is better. I can make this better. Let's try it. And you do try it. I was too nice to say go away. Or, and as a kid growing up, when you get nothing, you kind of feel like you're getting everything, don't you? And it's tough, but you look at some of the best players, like people never heard of him. Some people, David Drysdale, like, been on tour 20 years.
Yeah.
And he's used the same set of Callaway clubs for 10 years or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot in that for me.
It's not broke, don't fix it, isn't it? 100%.
And like, I was in Dubai testing. I'd booked a session with the TaylorMade guys in Dubai before the Middle East swing. And I must have had maybe an hour with one of the reps. And it's a half-hearted job, you know. Oh, yeah, that driver's, yeah, look at this, Chris. It's good. Yeah, take it away. And you take it. Justin Rose was there. He was 2 days doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's trying every shaft, every head, goes for lunch, comes back out, does it again. Next day, does it again. Like, that's properly doing it.
Yeah.
So he goes away with the confidence that it's better. Like, I've had like a quick fix band-aid. Yeah, this driver goes 2 yards further, not used it on the course. And you're kind of psychologically pushed into using it, really, if you're not strong enough to really test it. So,
and does that go back to the point what you mentioned before about being selfish? And obviously when you're on tour, you've got to be selfish and make your own decisions for you and not just say, oh, that looks good.
Definitely, 100%, mate. Yeah, you know what I mean? You've got to do it for you. You've got to have a plan. You've got to know what you want, and it's got to be right for you. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of nice people out there, but there's also a lot of people who are doing stuff for themselves and not you. And I mean, they're wanting to make money out of you as a player, or like some managers, or like reps wanting you to use their products. Like, you'll be hitting balls with a TaylorMade driver for an hour testing clubs. Next minute, Mr. Callaway's and it stood next to you. Why don't you try this one? You know what I mean? And it's like they're not worried about stepping on someone else's toes. If you're not a contracted player, then they'll
give you another number to them, aren't you?
Yeah, you're just a club count. So like, I was contracted to TaylorMade driver for 2016 and 17, but that was it, nothing else. Ball tightlist, but no iron contract, no other contracts, just TaylorMade driver for 2 years. And then in 18, TaylorMade had a massive like rebranding marketing structure where, because TaylorMade paid so many players to use their woods, all of a sudden they went, right, we're not going to pay those 80 people who are fringe players. We're going to play the top 10 in the world, and that's it. And you can see that, can't you?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm studying studio now, and you've got, this is an old picture there, but Tiger, Rahm, Rose, McIlroy, Day and Johnson. You know what I mean? They're paying millions, aren't they? So that was their way to do it. And I think Callaway then stepped in and went, right, well, we'll pay everyone to do it. So they paid everyone. So they went for like mass brand exposure, whereas TaylorMade went for top players.
Right.
So yes, I guess that was my 18, how it ended. And then the bad news was then back to Challenge Tour. So, which is a horrid place to go back to, really. If you're mentally not in a really good place, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because we done one of these interviews with Tom Gandy. Tom's obviously just he's just made the cut. He had some European Tour playing rights this year because of his category, and he's got a full Challenge Tour card. And he said that obviously the pressures for him going into the Q School are totally different to the lads coming down the way. Yeah, because obviously for him, he's got nothing to lose. I'm on the Euro Pro Tour at the moment. If I can make European Tour, fantastic. But Challenge Tour is even just as good for him. Whereas, like you've just said, they're coming down the other way. So how does that, what's the mindset from the other side then?
I guess the problem with golf is like, you can't really make a living at golf unless you're playing well on the main tour. Like the expenses are so high, and like you're making money on the Challenge Tour. You're playing really well on your top 20 and you're going to get off a Challenge Tour. But you're not making money if you're just messing around at 40th or 50th in the rankings. So the pressures, like the standards at the top of the Challenge Tour is great. Like the course setups aren't the same as main tour. So they're more resort courses, whereas the main tour courses are like tournament golf courses, a lot of them. Like they're structured around that 1 week of the year for that tournament. So they're a lot harder. But yeah, financially, like you're going from $2,000 expenses on main tour a week, and you're still paying $1,000 on the Challenge Tour a week. But the breakdown of money is zero. Like,
yeah,
it's crazy. Like you can play main tour and play okay, and you feel like you're getting a reward because you can still finish 30th and win $30,000. Whereas you can actually play all right on Challenge Tour and get nothing for it. You might get $1,000, and it's cost you $1,000.
Yeah.
So if you're in a position where you're depending on the financial side of it to play, then there's not many jobs. There's not many businessmen in the world who'd look at that Challenge Tour job and go, not a good business. Not a good business you're running there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
There's not many businesses where you spend $1,000 every week and don't earn more than $1,000 and keep going.
Yeah.
But it's so good that you've actually brought finances into it, because every single person on the Euro Pro, every single person, even like into the seniors, sort of all talk about money being the main issue. So you're just like the icing on the cake, because obviously you've been on the European Tour as well, to just say, if you haven't got money, you might as well just forget about it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, people say if you're good enough, you'll get there, right? So if you are good enough, you can get there, but you know, it's hard, because if you can't pay to go, then it doesn't matter how good you are, does it? You can't go. Like, don't get me wrong. If you're amazing and you've just got a 10 grand credit card and you're amazing, you spend that 10 grand, you might get there. But you know, there's not many, is there? You've got Rory McIlroy, who got a few starts on tour and kept his card. I can't think of many more guys, you know, like in America, you've got your Morikawas and your Wolves and stuff. But there's not many examples, is there, of a guy getting the card and saying, Ollie Fisher. But I'm pretty sure from Ollie Fisher, Walker Cup, top amateur, signing with IMG, he probably had the finances and didn't have that worry. But, you know, I mean, if you're a +3 golfer and you're not in the EGU setup or anything and you've got no money and you're starting at Euro Pro level, it's a big ask.
Yeah,
it's tough. And that's what I say to people, like, I need to come to Myersco and do those chats, like, and they always asked about sponsorship. And I just said to, like, young lads, like, I couldn't encourage you more to spend time at the golf club, like, meet members, show them what you're doing, be willing, be a professional from the start, like, get them on side with your journey and what you're doing, and they'll buy into you with it. So I wrote a blog for 10 years, like nearly every event, and
it's hard to monetize what I actually got out of that, but I'm guessing 15 to 20 grand or something from people giving me a couple of grand to help me out after reading it. Like one guy, his son was a keen golfer, and he said, he rung me and said, Chris, can I have a chat? I was like, yeah, helped his son out at a chat. I've been reading your blog, loving your story. Can I help you out and pay for Q School? You know what I mean? And like that, getting people in the story and buying into it and wanting to help you then and be part of the journey. And I probably maybe did too much, like got people kind of shared the journey and the experience so much. It wasn't selfish enough, but yeah. Then again, on the other hand, that's probably what kept me playing as well, really.
Yeah.
Is that chrishansengolf.com, like your website where you blog? Because I read a few little scripts on there. Is that what it is?
Yeah, just did that. I did that since probably 2010, maybe something. Yeah, all. I used to write it on a plane going out and a plane coming back. And I mean, the messages you get were amazing. And like I said, off the back of that, probably 15 grand or something, maybe, of people wanting to help out. So it didn't cost me anything. But for people, like, work out at the golf club, be nice at the golf club, meet people. There's enough people at the golf club who will help you out. You were in a golf day. I did a golf day 3 years in a row. Like, if they don't like you, they're not going to come out, they're not going to spend money. Did a share scheme that first year, and I couldn't recommend that more. It's hard for some people at a club where there's more than maybe 2 or 3 pros or top amateurs, but like I say, I was the only one. But yeah, that's a big piece of advice, I'd say.
Yeah, definitely. No. So obviously then you spent that full year on Challenge Tour last year, did you?
Yeah.
And so how did that season go? Because I know obviously you've now sort of, am I right in understanding you've taken a different route now with the new tour you've started, which we'll come on to?
Yeah, well, I played Challenge Tour. I played full year. I think I played 2 tour events. Actually made the cut in both tour events as well. I finished 30th in the Spanish Open at the end of the year. I finished 73rd on Challenge Tour. So top 70 keep the card, full card. So I've actually got probably 12 starts next year or something.
Yeah,
on Challenge Tour. So I've still got a decent enough category on Challenge Tour, really. But I played okay last year. No, I didn't play horrendous. I never really play horrendous. I'll always shoot 74 or better.
Yes.
But on Challenge Tour, if you don't make 20 birdies a week, then you're not making money. It's not my goal. I'd have to really change my goal for my mindset, I think, to play Challenge Tour. Whereas that's where... I didn't change as a golfer overnight from Challenge Tour to Main Tour that year, but my golf suited the Main Tour more because, like I said, I drove the ball well. So on Challenge Tour, you can get away with hitting it pretty wide and it's load of birdies and you can hit it from anywhere. Whereas all of a sudden you go on Main Tour and that course has been set up for 6 months with rough growing on the side of fairways. All of a sudden the premium on hitting fairways and greens doubles.
Yeah.
And I did that, so I kind of got that reward for being a better driver of the ball, and did well, really. Like I say, I was good at making 3 birdies and no bogeys a lot of the time. I had a lot of bogey free rounds. So yeah, Challenge Tour is a tough place. You know, it's you're counting the pennies. You know, you're spending £1,000, and you know if you don't finish inside the top 20, then it's not the way you should look at golf, breaking even. But last year, it certainly was a place where I knew I had to make money, and my sponsors had stopped supporting me really on Challenge Tour, and all of a sudden it was really, really tough. So yeah, just I guess the pressures were there to play well.
Yeah.
Like, it feels almost like just by the tone of your voice, the way you're talking about it now, it feels like the wind's out your sails a little bit towards the playing side, or are you just still going to play on, sort of thing?
No, it's getting there. I'd lost the. I'll be honest with you, I'd lost the process and I'd lost wanting to practice. And like, I used to be so like regimented and disciplined in my practice and like the small gains and getting better. And I'd just lost that. I still enjoy competing and I still like playing, but I'm under no illusion that if you don't practice and do what I did, then I'm not going to compete. So like, I played a few of my 2020 events and played all right, but I'm playing for last place check. You know, I mean, the guys out there playing full time and doing all the stuff I used to do. So unless I have a bit of a one-off day and play really, really well, which I could do, but I'm not giving myself the best chance. So there's no point doing it really. So for me going forward, coaching's been great. I've loved it. I love being around at home. I've been at home since November. Like my newest born's just gone over one, and I've seen her every day, whereas the other two, I hardly saw them. So things have changed, but like I'm practicing and playing more now than I've ever have done in the last 6 months. So I'm getting back into it. I know if I'm disciplined and structure that time in between teaching and other things I've got going on, then I can be competitive. So it feels to me that I'll keep doing what I'm doing. I'll probably play a few Euro Pros, a few Challenge Tours, and go to Q School at the end of the year.
Brilliant. If we said to, I can't remember who we spoke to, but we said that once you go up to the main tour, you buy a bigger house, and then you outlive your means, and all of a sudden you're sort of like spending the kids like nappy monies and stuff. Like that pressure sort of comes back onto it, obviously. Yeah. Not that you're in that position, but like, does it, like, obviously it sort of gets to the point where you think I've got to get a job, and like you've got the coaching and all that, and the tour going on, which is quality as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, you do live to your means, don't you? Like, I moved to Marbella for 2 years, lived in Marbella. my wife always wanted to live abroad, so we went out and tried it. We loved it, but it's a hell of an expensive place to live. Kids were in international schools. We had a lot of stuff off course when sort of not wrong, but didn't go our way that year. We'd still love to be in Spain now, but we ended up coming home. We got pregnant again and had our third, so we came back. But yeah, you do. It's, I mean, I think that's where I've never been stupid, never wasted money. But that is a good piece of advice for people is you've got to look ahead. Like, it's great living for now, which I totally get. Like, but financially, you've got to make sure you've got a bit of a backup plan, or you're in a comfortable position to do things going forward. I think that's another piece of advice. Like, you need a good accountant, like, as well. I've had some nightmares with accountants, and that was something what really played on my mind. Like, just, yeah, torrid. Hate that word.
Yeah, because you don't really realise, do you? Obviously, as a golfer, I suppose all you want to do is you just want to go out and play and perform, practice. But it's the logistics that come with the golf, like you've said, the accountant side to it, booking your hotels, organising your travel and things. It becomes more about just playing golf, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there is a lot more to it than just playing golf. But I guess the best players in the world, that is all they do.
Yeah.
But they pay a lot of money for that, but they're earning a lot of money. It's that catch-22, what comes first? Like, do you invest and spend and spend and spend to get in a position where you can play your best golf, or do you have to play good to then pay for that? I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? I think I'd be interested to have known how my career would have gone if I'd had an endless pot of money to keep playing golf. You know what I mean? That would be, and that's the same for a lot of people, isn't it? Yeah. Like, there's a lot of good players who have not had the chance. I've had the chance, don't get me wrong. That's not me, but there's a lot of like amazing young talents who have give it a year and then you never see them again.
Yeah.
It's quite sad, really. But I think it's a funny one, golf. You expect it to be something, and then for a lot of people, it's nothing like they expected. And I think a lot of people expect that instant success, and if they don't get it, they can't deal with it.
Yeah, what we're finding when we're speaking to people is it does take 3 or 4 years being a professional, grinding it out on the certain tours before you sort of get used to the elements and the environment and you get to winning. Obviously, some people are different. I know you won early on, but I know a lot of people that are spending 2 or 3 years before they really crack on to earning a bit of money. And it's just how long are you willing to keep breaking even or even coming at a loss before you make that turnaround?
Yeah, but it's not even just you, is it? Because like, it's your relationships. It's like you get a girlfriend and like she's in a decent job and earning money, and you're earning absolutely naff all. Like the pressures of that relationship. If you want to be with that person, and she don't want to be with someone who's not earning money and not, you know what I mean? It's hard, isn't it? Like that's where the selfishness comes in. But then again, you've also got a life to live as well away from golf, if that's what you want. So I think I was fortunate that me and my wife have been together since we were 15. So I never had that issue because all she ever knew was golf.
No.
If you're a single guy just getting out on tour, like, okay, it has its benefits as well. But then how do you meet someone? That's an important part of your life. But like, how do you like meet a girl out when you come home for the weekend after missing the cut and then go out and off away for 3 months to South Africa? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It'd be funny as well. Like, you meet a girl and she introduces you to her dad and say, like, oh, you're a professional golfer. Like, you must be doing well. You're this. Like, oh, I'm actually broke. I haven't got a penny.
So that's a really, like, key aspect, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
Like, if you're going to be happy on the course, you've got to be happy off the course.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's a big thing.
So talk to us a bit about the tour then, Chris. The tour that you've got going on now. I know obviously that was, is it first year, second year, is it?
First year last year, yeah.
First year last year. So how did that come about, and how did you get that set up, and what's the script with it?
Yeah, so a good friend of mine, Adam, who I set up the tour with, he was a professional for a bit, played mini tour stuff. I mean, it fits the bill, like, played all the mini tour stuff, but never really progressed, so then just didn't want to do it anymore. He was caddying for me quite a bit. He caddied for me in Madrid, Spanish Open last year. And we've talked about it loads, like mini tours. And we felt there was like just an opportunity to do it. There's nothing really this side of the country. And we just thought, we just wrote some notes down after about 3 hours of writing notes down one night. Like, it was quite strange because it was like the best week I've played all year. I'd made the cut and I was like 20th in the Spanish Open. I was talking about doing other things. So obviously, my mind wasn't in the right place, was it? And yeah, we just went for it. Like, it just spiraled from within a week. We got 12 venues lined up. Within a month, we got 20 venues lined up. We had a few sponsors wanting to chip in and help us get going. And obviously, I played that Jordan Mixed Open that year. We just thought it was a great chance and time to do that and get the female side involved as well, because I know there's nothing for them to really play in. So it went miles better than we probably ever expected it to that first year. And the plans for it this year are great as well. And it's getting well supported, and it's bridged a gap for a lot of people to play. So yeah, just we've loved it. It's been rewarding. I've loved seeing some of the guys win their first pro events and providing them more of an opportunity to like I said to you, there's 100 guys turn pro every year and there's nowhere to play. So we've all of a sudden provided a platform.
Yeah.
22 events for people to, Nick Poppleton this year, obviously this year was an interesting one with COVID and EuroPro was cancelled, but all of a sudden he won 10 grand this year or something. Like, what would he have done without it nearly? And I've really enjoyed it, and like, I'm coaching quite a few people now off that tour as well, which is brilliant. So
brilliant.
Really, really helping them through what I did. So yeah, no, the tour's been great. Like I said, 23 events next year, and hopefully it works nicely around everyone else's schedules.
Is there any in the Northwest?
We go Lancaster, Stockport, Worsley Park, Marriott, Alton Old Links. That's nice. Probably they're the four West ones, probably.
Yeah.
We'll have to come and play, be here, two amateurs in one of them, probably either Bolton or Worsley Park's a good one. That's a proper Myersco track, isn't it?
Yeah, proper Myersco, yeah.
I wouldn't mind going back there and having a little hack around there.
Redemption. Yeah,
one to play in the summer, not the winter, isn't it, that one?
Yeah, it's a fog, isn't it?
Yeah. But no, it's a good track, good course, yeah.
No. Is the schedule out then on online that we can access?
Yeah,
well, we'll do that, definitely.
Yeah, we will. We'll get over and have a
round. Do you get many amateurs playing?
Yeah, we get. We've had between 10 and 50 at most events, of 5 and less, yeah. So, yeah, get yourself into some.
We will, yeah, definitely.
100%.
Yeah. Awesome, guys.
Have you got any open qualifying or anything coming up next year? You going to have a go at that again, or?
Yeah, I probably will do, yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine I would do, yeah. It's just a nice one-day event to go and give it a crack. So play well and open some doors, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. 100%. Well, it's been great getting some insight from you, mate. We've really enjoyed it. Appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. And obviously, hopefully, well, I think I'm pretty sure that the information you give is going to help a lot of people out there. So really appreciate it, mate.
I'm glad that we waited to get you on. I'm glad we didn't get you on first. And probably people would be like, I'm not coming on now. You've had him on. What can I tell you?
No, not at all. No, but I'm going to do some practice now. Look. Bloody hell.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, you're back in Barbados, aren't there, are you?
Well, look, mate, let you get back to practice, and really appreciate you taking the time. And good luck with everything.
Good luck.
Perfect.
We'll see you at one of the events next year. We'll be wearing the Bogey Boys stickers, yeah?
Awesome, mate. All right, boys.
Take care, mate. Bye, bye.